Welcome to episode 160 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is the writer and podcaster Will Sloan. He has a new project out, the Journal of Stoogeological Studies, an unauthorized Three Stooges fanzine. Will, welcome back to Junk Filter.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I invited Will on the show to talk about Burt Reynolds, a favorite of ours, but we're going to be concentrating our discussion on the strange little set of projects that he made in the 80s as his star was declining. I think we can learn a lot about the rise and fall of an actor by looking at this very, very slow decline that he experienced.
Yes, and I should probably sort of announce my position in relation to Burt Reynolds off the top. I am, over the years, of course, I've seen, just because you do, a lot of Burt Reynolds movies. You know, I've seen Deliverance and, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex and a million others. Boogie Nights, of course. But as to the, you know, the classic Burt, the Burt, you know, that is the foundation of his legend, I am still in a very Burt curious stage. I like him very much. I like what I've seen. Smokey and the Bandit has its charms, of course. What was the one that we watched at Fantascope that time? Seamus, I believe,
yes.
Is a classic. And last year watching Heat on Netflix, really kind of got me going. But I'm also Burt curious because when you compare him to Clint Eastwood, who was the other star kind of his approximate milieu as well as star power at the same time. You know, Clint Eastwood, still alive, of course, but even when Burt was alive, they had a big drifting apart in terms of their star power and legendary status. Like, Burt, towards the end, you know, had become a bit of an abject figure. And Clint can still go wherever he wants, do whatever he wants. So I'm interested in discussing that with you. As a man who was there, you know, on the ground floor, you were going to see these movies in the 80s. And I'm very interested in sort of hearing from you, because I look at this filmography and the decline speaks for itself. And I'd like to know from you kind of what the experience of watching this star fade was.
Well, Burt was the most famous actor in the United States at the very beginning of the 80s. Smokey and the Bandit was the second biggest hit of the decade after Star Wars.
Insane. It's unfathomable. And it's like, you think of like the canon of 1970s movies, both in terms of like the auteur ones, you know, your Coppolas, your Scorsese's, and then the sort of like fan favorites, like, you know, Star Wars. And Smokey and the Bandits doesn't seem to fit into any of those categories. Like, do people watch Smokey and the Bandit, like in the red states still? Like, does it still have a constituency? I don't know.
I think so. I mean, maybe after the recording, I'll go look around and see if there are some Smokey and the Bandit box sets available.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, his star declined so quickly in the 1970s, and especially in the late 1970s, you know, Burt Reynolds and Clint Eastwood were like big Warner Brothers fixtures. Mm-hmm. And they had so many things in common, including that they directed themselves in movies, too.
Which is fascinating. And, like, I look at the filmography and, you know, if you watch, like, the Siskel and Ebert reviews of the Burt Reynolds movies through the 80s, there was a general sense, like, Burt sort of became a symbol of the star who stopped caring at all about quality control. All those Hal Needham films, like if I were Gene Siskel, I would say, Burt Reynolds is picking a paycheck over a script and it's his fans who are suffering. It was just like that, like, and wildly prolific throughout the 80s, just making one bad movie after another, one flop after another. It took a long time for that star to finally fade.
Another fun fact about Burt Reynolds' 70s heyday is that he had a disco in the Omni Hotel in Atlanta. The most exciting thing about this disco is that it had a disco floor with stained glass and a drawing of Burt Reynolds.
Huh. Very nice.
But sadly, it went out of business after only a year of operation. But imagine going to the Burt Reynolds Disco in Atlanta.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I have seen At Long Last Love, where, you know, Burt, God love him. I don't think anybody could have, like, you know, the Fred and Ginger movies were made back when everybody was like, you know, had honed their skills for decades in vaudeville. But I don't think we've seen evidence of Burt being a great dancer on screen. So I don't necessarily think, you know, he's the one to lend his name to such an establishment. But just in terms of like charisma, in terms of vibe, he's the kind of guy you would want to meet at a disco. So I guess that is to say I'm ambivalent.
Exist as a Thursday, Friday, Saturday fever type. We have the same people come here all the time, every night. It's a regular disco type of crowd that just moves around Atlanta. I think this just gives everybody a chance to get out and be a star, you know? Get out in front of everybody and be a star.
You may call it Saturday night fever, but it is really, thank you, the same sweet sickness that Americans have been experiencing for decades, that irresistible urge to get out, have fun, and feel good. And in Atlanta, it appears to have reached epidemic proportions. Mark Ricard, Action News.
Marlon Brando hated Burt Reynolds so much. Have you ever seen the video of Brando going off on Reynolds?
No, please tell me, what did he say?
Yeah, but by the time you get the bells over it and all that stuff, who the fuck's gonna know?
I don't think he is. I think it's Burt Reynolds.
That's one of the reasons we're doing it.
Don't say that name around me.
You not like him?
He is the epitome of something that makes me want to throw up.
He's a nice guy.
He is?
You want to come in here? No, you don't.
I don't know why I hate him.
No, he is a nice guy, as a matter of fact.
He can't be. He's the epitome of everything that's disgusting about the thespian. Just holy.
Where did you get that idea? I don't know him at all.
He worships at the temple of his own narcissism.
You want to try
him? Totally narcissistic person.
Well, I don't want to meet him either.
Brando really, really hated Reynolds. I think it was a little psychological because, especially when he was younger, Reynolds was just as handsome and beautiful as Marlon Brando was, too. Like, they looked very similar to me physically.
Yeah. To Brando's younger self.
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of see it. They're both, you know, masculine and handsome in that sort of way, like powerfully charismatic, very physical. Yeah. So what was the first Burt joint you saw in a theater?
Well, I insisted on seeing a couple of Burt Reynolds movies as a kid. Like, for instance, I saw Hooper in a movie theater. And
which was like number six that year at the box office. It was a monster hit.
You know what's so funny about Hooper is it has a sustained attack on Peter Bogdanovich throughout. Because Robert Klein is playing this obnoxious artiste director in the film who's clearly modeled on Bogdanovich, including wearing an ascot. And at the very, very end of Hooper, Burt Reynolds sucker punches him, which was supposed to be something to make Bogdanovich mad, because I guess they worked together on At Long Last Love, which
and
was like a notorious bomb. And Nickelodeon.
And did you know that Burt Reynolds is directly responsible for the falling out between Bogdanovich and Orson Welles?
No.
Because I think either Orson Welles was the guest host or Burt Reynolds was the guest host on The Tonight Show, and the other one was the guest. And they went off on this just bashing Peter Bogdanovich for like 10 straight minutes on TV. And Bogdanovich sent Welles a letter the next day like, "Well, I'm glad I tuned in to find out what you really thought of me." And then Welles sent an envelope with two separate letters and a third letter that said, "Pick one of these and decide which one you want." And one of them was a profuse apology. And the other letter said, "You deserved it," signed OW. So for 10 years, those two weren't really speaking until shortly before Welles' death. And we have Burt to thank for that. Have you? Oh, sorry. Can I just say one more thing on this subject? Have you seen the unsold pilot of the Orson Welles show?
Of course.
with Bert as the guest.
Yeah.
It fucking rocks because they're dressed exactly the same. And the idea of Orson Welles being a sort of like acting like the little brother to Burt Reynolds, like a little toady to the man who made Citizen Kane. It's so funny.
Mm-hmm. I never saw the Smokey and the Bandit movies.
Still to this day, you've never seen them?
I saw them on television over time.
Sure. Probably over and over again, right? Did you see Smokey is the Bandit or whatever that third installment was with Jackie Gleason? I guess that version they dumped, but.
Well, it's a long story because for the longest time, Smokey and the Bandit 3 came out in like 1983 or something like that. Burt Reynolds refused to be in it.
Yeah.
So Universal really needed to make a third Smokey because even Smokey and the Bandit 2 was one of the biggest hits of its year as well. Mm-hmm. But by this point, Reynolds was pretty much finished with, he wasn't necessarily finished working with Hal Needham, but he was finished with the Smokey character. Smokey and the Bandit 3 was originally filmed as something called Smokey is the Bandit, where Jackie Gleason played both the sheriff and the Bandit. So it's Jackie Gleason running around in the red shirt with the hat and a Burt mustache.
And all that exists is a haunting photograph of Jackie Gleason dressed as the Bandit looking awful.
But a few years ago, somebody unearthed a preview trailer, which people swore up and down existed, but there was no proof of it, but they did uncover it. And it's a parody of the opening of Patton with Jackie Gleason as Patton talking about how, you know, the only way to beat the Bandit is to become the Bandit.
I has become my greatest enemy. I've seen the trailer many times. Yes.
I have put myself in his place. Also his boots and his shirt and his hat and his coat and his mustache. In short, I have succeeded in becoming my own worst enemy. The Bandit. So if you think the first two go-rounds was something, you just watch my smoke this time. Some bitch.
This has been Buford T. Justice, asking you to support your local sheriff. Smokey is the Bandit, part 3.
So what they wound up doing was they because it tested so badly and audience was so confused as to why Jackie Gleason is playing two parts in this film, that they reshot all of the parts with Gleason with Jerry Reed. They paid him to come back and him to wear the red shirt and the cowboy hat and the mustache. So they reshot the entire part and then pretended that it never existed in the original version. This is my Magnificent Ambersons. I want to see Smokey is the Bandit.
It sounds like a Donald Kaufman concept, you know?
Another fun fact about Smokey and the Bandit 3 is that they did eventually convince Burt Reynolds to come back to do a cameo. Mm-hmm. And he does his entire scene in the car.
Steven Seagal style.
He doesn't have the classic Burt mustache. He has the sort of thinned out City Heat mm-hmm. Burt mustache. So it doesn't look quite right. And he literally like drove up into the shot, read all his lines, and then drove away. Like, it looks like they had him for 15 minutes. But the strange thing is that on the syndicated television version, it's a dream sequence in the movie. Hmm. In the syndicated television version, that scene is like 7 minutes long. In the theatrical, it's like 2.5. I'll tell you something that is very embarrassing. I think I saw the Cannonball Run 3 times when I was a kid.
Well, it was inevitable that we were going to talk about the Cannonball Run, which is, you know, if you watch it, is, I don't want to say it's unwatchable because it's obviously very watchable in certain ways, but it's like, it doesn't feel finished, you know, yeah. Like no scene makes sense. There's no sort of like coherence to the style or, there's no kind of like point A to point B logic to anything that happens. And then when Dom DeLuise like shows up in that superhero guise at the end, like what is the reality of that within this? I don't know. It's like, it's very much like a celebrity roast on screen and God, like Dean Martin in that movie is just so depressing. Did you know who Jackie Chan was when you saw it?
Well, this was my introduction to Jackie Chan. This is what I have to thank Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham for. And to make things even more interesting, that people may not realize, that the Cannonball Run was co-produced by Golden Harvest.
Yeah. Part of their, they also produced Speed Zone, the unofficial third in the franchise. Yeah.
So we have Burt Reynolds technically to thank for Jackie Chan. And of course, everybody's in the movie for 15 minutes, maybe max, except for Burt and Dom DeLuise and I guess Farrah Fawcett is in it.
So I never finished Cannonball Run 2, although I promise I'll get back to it at some point so I can log one more Jackie movie on Letterboxd. But I never finished it. But I mean, like, the famous thing with that movie is that Frank Sinatra shows up and he's clearly shot completely separately from everybody else.
Yeah.
Did you ever see, there's no structure to this discussion, but now I'm just thinking of Burt movies I want to quiz you about. I've not seen this one, but have you seen Stroker Ace?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas either.
Oh, monster hit in its day, almost completely forgotten now. So looking at Burt Reynolds' filmography, like, the years, 1980 to 1982, 83, he's still kind of on top of the world, at least box office wise. Would it be fair to speculate that, because by the time Heat came out, the reviews had a general tenor of, look, Burt's been slipping and he's kind of got to figure it out if he wants to stay a star. Would you say that the turning point might have been like the 1-2 punch of Cannonball Run 2 and City Heat in 1984?
I think so. Have you ever watched City Heat? You would think that I would have seen it by now, but I haven't.
Yeah, and likewise, you'd think I would have seen it too, but it just has a completely non-existent reputation, Like, nobody seems to like it.
It was the big Warner Brothers Christmas release that year.
And it was crushed by Beverly Hills Cop.
The interesting thing about Burt is that, he had all these sort of cornball movies that were massive hits. But for some reason, I think he was trying to get back to the critically acclaimed, actor that he had been briefly in the 70s in things like Deliverance. Mm. Another Burt movie that I've never actually watched is the Alan J. Pakula movie that he did called Starting Over, which was written by James L. Brooks and it co-stars Candice Bergen. I should watch it.
Well, The Man Who Loved Women in 1983 by Blake Edwards, who of course was coming off some major hits at the time, that seems another like bid for prestige. What was the one? Oh, Breaking In from 1989 by Bill Forsyth, which is a kind of like,
which I've heard is good.
A last ditch. This is at the very, very tail end of his superstardom, a sort of last ditch bid to get the critics back on board, and which mm-hmm. flopped. And then throughout the 90s, like the 90s are like a really weird decade, abject hack work, like Cop and a Half, mixed with, attempts to mix it up with, Citizen Ruth, Striptease. He obviously has a very colorful supporting role in Striptease. And then finally, Boogie Nights, which is the one that anyone of my generation, probably any casual moviegoer right now, if you said name a Burt Reynolds performance, it would be that one, right?
He's so good in it. And of course, he hated every minute of it. Mm-hmm. He fired his agent as soon as it was done. He punched out Paul Thomas Anderson while they were on the press tour as well.
And then later, of course, turned down the Tom Cruise role in Magnolia. So it was an auspicious comeback that was incredibly short-lived. After that, it was back to doing like Albert Pune films. No disrespect to the great Albert Pune, but it not necessarily where Burt Reynolds probably wanted to be at that time. And then in the 2000s, there would be the occasional movie that would sort of bring him out, like The Dukes of Hazzard, The Longest Yard remake, sort of just as a nostalgic token. Until finally, around the 2010s, Burt was simply not presentable anymore. He'd done some stuff to his face, and I don't know if you've seen it's not a great movie or anything, but it's sort of worth a look just for sentimental value. The Last Movie Star, which is kind of his targets, his Max Rose. It's again not that great, but it has a certain charm to it just because it's obviously made with love for him.
I think that Reynolds really fumbled the bag, though, with Boogie Nights. Like, that was the when that movie was a new movie, it looked like, wow, Burt Reynolds is back. He actually looks great, and he gives a great performance in it. You know, who knows? This could be a career renaissance. And then, you know, 2 years later, he's in Driven.
Yeah.
The Rennie Harlan movie where he looks like he's had plastic surgery. Boogie Nights is one movie that I value a lot because it's kind of the last hurrah for the classic Burt. He looked about as good as he always had, and then he never looked that good again.
Yeah, and he looked as good as he always had, but with the gravitas of age. He had a new presence. God, that monologue he gives early in the movie where it's like, when they spurt that joy juice, I want them to sit in it because they're so wrapped up in the story. Like, God, the velvety texture of his voice in that monologue. Oh, God damn. Yeah. So good. So good. And, you know, anybody could recognize that it was a very smart career move for him at the time, you know, sort of like working with all these young up and coming actors, working with this very exciting director, a very theoretically, a very canny attempt to position him in a modern context. But when you read the oral histories of that movie or anybody who worked on it and gave an interview, there was a sense that he was very, well, first of all, he was uncomfortable with the subject matter. Thought it was a little sleazy. And when you look at his Golden Globes acceptance speech, you can tell he's still reticent about the subject matter. He's weirdly like apologetic about it in that speech. And obviously uncomfortable, as everybody who worked on the movie will say, giving up the stardom, you know, being part of an ensemble, being not the main character in a movie. And it, you know, it's too bad.
And apparently his attitude towards winning the Golden Globe and campaigning for this movie that he didn't even respect probably cost him that Oscar, which went to Robin Williams that year. But like, Reynolds was the favorite.
Yeah. And I mean, Robin Williams, obviously a very like well-liked guy, you know, who I'm sure campaigned for it very hard.
It's all part of the Burt legacy, though.
You know, I like the evolution of Burt from the 70s to the 80s. Like in the 70s, tell me if I'm oversimplifying, but one associates him as a sort of like red state rural figure, you know. The Smokey and the Bandit movies, the Cannonball Run movies, for instance. In the 80s, his aesthetic becomes much kind of like grimier and more urban and more downbeat generally. There's a sort of like nocturnal, bad energy, big city vibe to the 80s stuff compared to the 70s stuff. The 70s stuff is all like blue skies and like Dom DeLuise and stuff like that.
There was this weird period in the early 80s where 70s movies were still coming out.
Yes.
Like Prince of the City, Cutter's Way. But to me, Sharky's Machine is like a 1979 Warner Brothers movie that came out in 1981.
Yeah.
Burt Reynolds is Sharky. He's a smart cop, but somebody's in his way.
You're an outcast about to lose that badge of yours.
What he hears, he can't use.
Tell him there's no way that he can win. Do you understand?
What he knows, he can't prove.
Sure. The tapes are gone.
And what he sees, he can't have. But nobody leans on Sharky's Machine. Sharky's Machine, rated R. Now play. Check newspaper for local listing.
The first movie we're going to talk about is one that he directed that I implored you to watch, Sharky's Machine.
Yeah, so this movie caught me off guard a little bit. In some ways, it was exactly what I was expecting, but in other ways, quite different. So this movie comes from what I think we can still consider like the Burt Golden Age, maybe the Indian summer of the Burt Golden Age. You know, he's still a box office draw, and this one is sandwiched between a bunch of Cannonball Run and Smokey and the Bandit movies. He did direct this one, and you know, it has the kind of like affect, the texture of a Dirty Harry ripoff. But the tone of it and the pace of it are both oddly downbeat, and the subject matter is quite depressing as well. Frankly, I was expecting to have a more conventionally good time with it. I was expecting more like fist bump moments than I got, although there are a few. What has been your experience with this movie?
Sharky's Machine had incredible trailers when I was a kid, and I also thought the very title Sharky's Machine was funny.
Oh yeah.
Bert is Sharky and nobody leans on Sharky's Machine. It's like, what the fuck is Sharky's Machine? But I caught it on cable one night many years later, and I was like, this movie's actually not bad.
No, it is.
Reynolds does a pretty good job here as a director. It has really good mise-en-scene, if I may use that word on the show. Like it's set in this very chilly-looking Atlanta, and you kind of feel a chill while you're watching it. The vibes in this movie are quite good.
Yeah.
It has this huge all-star cast loaded with great character actors, Brian Keith, Charles Durning, Bernie Casey. They're all these tough as nails vice cops. The bad guy's Vittorio Gassman. The female lead is Rachel Ward, who was like a fashion model who broke into acting. She was cast only a few days before production started. Mm-hmm. Richard Libertini, who I love, is along for the ride. Yeah, as Sharky's.
From Popeye.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He's his Sharky's old schoolboy chum. Sharky takes down some bad guys at the beginning of the movie. He gets demoted to the Vice Patrol because I guess a couple of people get killed in this weird shootout on a bus. Mm-hmm. And he's sent down to Vice to work with this group. And he basically is obsessed with putting his machine back together, which is what he had in the previous police role that he had. But the MVP of this movie, of course, is the great Henry Silva, who plays mm-hmm. the mob's cokehead assassin, Carlos Scarelli, aka Billy Score.
Oh, I mean, what does one say about Silva?
Jesus,
I mean,
Christ.
well, he obviously has a natural advantage, his face. There's something about his look that I think really fits in with the style of this movie, which, as you say, is chilly and is also like just kind of like black, for want of a better word. There's something, it's almost as if like the screen is doused in like car exhaust and oil. And there's something about Henry Silva's face that I think fits with the texture of that. Would you say that there's a conscious attempt in this movie by Bert to sort of interrogate his star persona? At this time, he would have been doing a lot of like pretty lightweight fare. And in this movie, you know, he's not always the most likable guy. Most of the movie is centered around his sort of erotic fixation on this call girl who he's doing 24/7 surveillance on. He's a little creepy in a lot of the movie, as well as just a little sort of lost.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about with you is that this movie is kind of arty. Mm-hmm. For a Christmas season, star-driven cop movie, there's a great deal of melancholy running through this movie. And I think that Burt Reynolds was trying to be like John Boorman a little bit in this film.
Yeah, no, 100%. And his screen presence, you know, throughout the 70s, he was such a like likable guy. He was always on The Tonight Show doing quips. And in the movies, he has a certain, like Smokey and the Bandit, most of the movies, he does this kind of like smug, you know, like smirking thing. And in a lot of these 80s movies, he's settling into a more like leathery persona, for want of a better word. In some movies, you know, he was often accused by critics of seeming bored in the movies. And, you know, in at least one of the movies we're going to talk about later in this episode, he definitely is. But he's also trying to do like less. He's trying to there's obviously a strong Clint Eastwood influence on his performance style in these movies as well. I think he is actually trying to sort of age in these movies.
And the other Eastwood connection to this movie is that it starts like a Clint Eastwood movie would start, with helicopter shots over the city skyline of Atlanta. It has a almost complete jazz score, but I love how it starts with that great song Street Life, which was by Randy Crawford, which was used so well in Jackie Brown. But it comes from Sharky's Machine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the song was arranged by Doc Severinsen.
Oh, I missed that.
So I guess he made that connection, I guess, from being on The Tonight Show all the time.
Yeah, no doubt.
Street life. the film has a lot of visual language and nonverbal communication in it. And there are some actually very touching montages, even if they're not subtle, where I think Bert is trying to do the conversation. He's trying to do Vertigo. He's trying to do Rear Window.
A lot of Vertigo, the French Connection. Yeah.
Because there's a sweet sequence where Bert is sort of surveying the Rachel Ward character. He's got his binoculars and we see the reel-to-reel decks going. And there's a musical montage that's set to a jazz version of My Funny Valentine, mm-hmm. where through the magic of editing and doubling of imagery, they sort of put together the idea that they could be a good couple. Mm-hmm. And it has this weird sort of domestic feeling to it. And they keep cutting back and forth at very unsubtly, like Rachel Ward in her apartment smoking. And then they cut to Bert's blowing smoke rings across the way. Mm-hmm. Quite beautiful. It's like a longueur that a cop action movie wouldn't necessarily do.
Mm-hmm. Although still filled with plot.
Yes. A little too much plot. Mm-hmm. He's trying really hard to make a good movie and a stylish movie. I think the downbeat feeling of this movie probably prevented it from being a hit. But I think Bert might have thought, instead of making three Smokey movies, I should be making Sharky's Machine movies.
Yeah. Was it perhaps the relative failure of this movie? I mean, it still made $30 million. Like, it wasn't, you know, the biggest, like, he had bigger flops after this. But do you think the relative failure of this movie maybe contributed to the checked out nature of Bert and some of the later movies?
I think so. I sent you this video that I found of the premiere of the film in Atlanta with Reynolds and the cast, and it has real sort of fascist vibe to it. Like it's and it's like a fundraiser for the police, and they do a big onstage salute to the men and women of law enforcement in Atlanta. And
well, thank God the police are finally going to get some money.
So Bert's trying to be arty, but I found this other amazing quote when he's talking about the Henry Silva character, who's like a cokehead. Mm-hmm. Reynolds said, "In my picture, the good guys win and the bad guys, the dopers, lose. That's important to me. I don't like dopers. I get mad as hell when I hear that studios are coddling actors who are always high on cocaine."
This is, I think, why this movie, which I do like, isn't quite Tightrope, you know?
Yeah. He's not hard on himself, that's for sure, the way that Clint is in Tightrope.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, have you ever seen the next movie that he directed, Stick, from 1985?
No, I ran out of time to do it. I do want to watch it, though, because I've heard it's interesting. It was made when Bert was starting to look unwell.
Yes, and Bert had one final directorial effort in the year 2000 called The Last Producer, which was evidently some kind of comedy that went direct to video that has no reputation to speak of, which is a shame.
But I think Bert had the goods as a director. This is, having not seen every, I think Bert has like 12 directing credits or something. I haven't seen everything, but I think Sharky's Machine was a really noble attempt mm-hmm. to break out of the sort of commercial rut that he was in and try to sort of show what he could do and to play as part of an ensemble cast. I mean, he's clearly the star of the show, but it's not bad. But it also kind of looks at the end like they ran out of either time or money. There's a crazy ending where Henry Silva gets blown away through a window in an Atlanta skyscraper, and Dar Robinson did the stunt for the movie, but they don't show most of the stunt. They cut to a dummy flying down to Earth. As we see the dummy flying down to Earth, they suddenly smash cut from that to another telephoto shot from a helicopter of Sharky in his backyard pushing Rachel Ward on a tire swing.
Yeah.
So that we briefly see that they are a couple at the end, and then the helicopter just flies away over Atlanta, and that's the end of the movie. And if I had paid money to watch that movie in 1981, I'd wonder why it suddenly ended. I got the feeling as the 80s continued that Bert was working because he had to and not because he wanted to. A little background is that Bert had his jaw broken on the set of City Heat. And apparently he had trouble when the jaw got disconnected from the skull. And so he was experiencing terrible, terrible pain in his head. And he was taking painkillers all the time. And he lost a lot of weight in so doing, and he was sort of disappeared for a while in the public eye because of this condition. And in the tabloids, they all started saying that Burt Reynolds must have AIDS.
Wow.
And Burt eventually had to have these humiliating interviews to the press where he had to say, I don't have AIDS. He had to explain himself. But you saw just how thinned out he looks, especially in Stick. Like he looks unwell in the film. And this was also the early days of AIDS where everyone was really freaked out by the whole idea of this disease. And I guess Burt wanted to be thought of as a heterosexual man. And at the time, AIDS was considered a gay plague, you know, so.
Well, certainly Heat reestablishes his heterosexual credentials, a movie where he is very, very masculine, but in a kind of tired, old tired way, kind of like a, you know, a beat up pair of shoes. That's what he looks like.
The films that we're going to be talking about as we continue are paycheck roles, but I keep seeing glimmers of good movies trying to get out.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't revisit Heat for this podcast, but I have seen it and I love it. I find it, you know, just a perfect, like, lazy weekend afternoon movie. And also, like, one that I think just has a kind of melancholy vibe to it that really makes Burt's checked out star performance work, you know?
Burt Reynolds in the role you've been waiting for. Heat.
Hell, I'm a knockdown, blown up, shot at. I lectured on economics at Yale. I was National Gold Gloves champion 3 years in a row, and I'm fluent in 4 languages.
Well,
don't interrupt me, I'm not through.
There's more.
Yeah, I lie a lot.
If you need protection, Nick Escalante is your man.
His specialty is edged weapons. I suspect Nicholas is the most lethal man alive.
Who puts you in emergency?
Don't mess with these guys. Nobody can do what you can do.
You mean get people killed?
You gotta do it.
He's on an edge you've never seen before.
Want to know how long it's gonna take you to die? I'll give you a hint. Think in days.
Heat. Rated R.
This was a movie that was obviously intended to be a better movie. Mm-hmm. It has a screenplay by William Goldman, for God's sakes.
Which I gotta say, the movie is full of like snappy William Goldman patter. I know that Goldman himself disowned this movie, but I think he should be proud of it. It's got some good stuff.
The original director was Robert Altman.
And yeah, which is incredible. And obviously he was replaced by 2 credited directors, I believe. And when a movie has 2 credited directors, you know that it went very well.
Well, Altman didn't like Goldman's script. And when his cinematographer couldn't get a work visa, he was a Canadian cinematographer. Altman used that as his excuse to bail out. So they grabbed Dick Richards, who directed Farewell, My Lovely for the producer, Elliot Kastner. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that with Mitchum?
No, I never have.
It's interesting because it's trying to be a 40s movie and was made in the 70s. And I don't know whether it works because they're trying so hard to make it film noir. But Mitchum is so good in it that kind of cancels out the problems that you have with it. Mm-hmm. But Richards did not get along with Reynolds, to put it mildly. Reynolds punched Richards out on the set and broke his jaw.
I like how there are multiple stories of Burt Reynolds like punching directors.
So Richards quit and he was replaced by Jerry Jameson. And then Richards wound up coming back to the production, but then he was hospitalized when he fell off a camera crane. So this production was fraught with directors either being punched out by the star or falling to their
injured. The final project, this authorless text, I think is remarkably coherent, all things considered.
Richards and Jerry Jameson were both in arbitration for who got the credit. Mm-hmm. They actually added up everything and decided that Richards had directed the majority of the finished product. So he was the credited director, but then he said afterwards that he didn't want credit and he took a pseudonym. So he's R.M. Richards in the credits. Winning your arbitration and then taking a pseudonym is incredible. He also successfully sued Burt for $500,000 for the broken jaw.
But the plot features Bert as a sort of disillusioned former soldier of fortune who becomes a kind of bodyguard for hire. But that's not the full extent of his responsibilities, because the opening scene, somebody a great opening scene where like a guy hires him to like pick a fight with him at a bar, and he gets to beat him up so that he can impress like a woman. And it's a good opening scene because it sort of sets the tone, I think, for Bert's like screen presence and affect in the movie, which is of like humbled greatness or like self-loathing or like a man who has consciously played beneath his abilities, like, which is kind of where his star text was at that point.
Yes, absolutely. That was the vibe that I was getting from this, is that there's another level of text in this film, which is that Bert is putting on the hair shirt or something. Like, he does a lot of personal suffering in this movie. He puts himself through the ringer. His name is Nick Escalante, which I always thought was really funny. The commercials for Heat were the reason why I went to see it, because they talked about him as a master of edged weapons in the film. Yes. And
that can include a credit card. It can include anything with an edge.
So, you know, the other thing about Reynolds is that Reynolds is what Steven Seagal is trying to be. That's the other thing. Like, Seagal would have made Heat if he had a little more power.
Yes. Yes. And how would you define that? 'Cause I know what you mean.
Just like this walking statue who thinks of himself as more than just a pretty face, you know, or more than just a martial arts star. I've got a poet inside me kind of stuff. Because Seagal was also trying to do like artistic statements and rewriting scripts and stuff like that.
It's interesting.
But it all boils down to these dumb action movies. I also felt this while watching Malone, too, is that like, but Reynolds is convincing as this kind of person.
It's true. And I think you do see in some of these 80s movies an attempt by Reynolds to appear vulnerable in a way that Seagal never did. Now, mind you, it's undermined by the fact that Reynolds is incredibly vain and like can't like struggles against himself to appear vulnerable. So like throughout Heat, like he is sort of like perfectly coiffed in his way, you know. But I don't know, like the way he carries his body, I think his acting in the movie is like pretty good, honestly. I think he conveys melancholy and beaten downness, for want of a better term.
Well, we got to talk about his dream, which is to go to Venice. Let's talk about that.
Well, can I spoil the movie and say that I thought it was a bit of a cop-out that it ended with him actually going to Venice?
So funny. There's all this sad saxophone music over the soundtrack. And whenever Escalante is alone with his thoughts, he's just staring at posters in his office of Venice, like crappy travel agency posters of Venice.
But you
that's
know,
his dream, man.
Yeah.
When he gets that money, he's going to go to Venice. That's his dream.
Can we also talk about just the sort of B story of the movie? Sophie's Choice's own Peter McNichol as kind of Bert's beta friend who he has to teach to be cool.
You know, but they also do have good scenes together. There's that very long chat that they have in front of Glitter Gulch in Las Vegas. The vibes are really nice in that scene. Like, you just see, you know, a quarter mile of neon while Bert is talking about how he has a gambling problem. Like, he actually admits to it after McNichol witnesses this incredible self-annihilation sequence where Bert Reynolds has come into some money and he has a winning streak at the blackjack table, and he has he walks away at first, but then he decides that this is his night. He's got to follow it, and he makes even more money doing it. But then his fortunes turn in the other direction, and I thought it was so funny that this movie had his friend who was the blackjack dealer, played by Diana Scarwood, who was with him at the beginning of his lucky streak, and she's the blackjack dealer when he blows it all, and she's crying when he loses. he he should have held is the lesson in the movie, is that he gets beaten with a really bad hand too.
Yes, he should have held, but then also it didn't matter because he was destined to not hold. That's not who Nick Escalante is. You know, he's the man who gains it all and loses it. And the melancholy of this, I think, infuses the whole film. And it's like, it's just an interesting movie, I think, because it is somewhere between being a good and a bad movie. It has like elements of both. I say that with affection. Like, it is a movie that has those ridiculous action scenes, like incredibly camp scenes where he demonstrates being the master of edged weapons. It has a lot of like pretty corny and cliche stuff, but then it also has scenes like that gambling scene where, you know, it does really affect you. And like the cocktail of these clashing scenes and the emotions they inspire makes for an interesting mix.
Mm-hmm. And what finally tips this movie into the positive category for me, even if I know it's a bad movie ultimately, is I love the performance by an actress who I've always loved, and I wish that she had a bigger career, named Karen Young. Mm-hmm. And she's very, very good in this film. She's so good in it that Reynolds actually seems better in their scenes together. Like, she elevates his performance. She plays a sex worker who has a bad date, and we see her at the beginning of the movie staggering into a hospital.
The elevator went up. No, I didn't clock the floor. I had other problems, like how best to make my departure. And then we're in his suite, and I said, "Where's the party?" And he said, "You are." Then he signals for the other two to leave, and I'm working on a good sob story when he said it. "Are you the lucky bitch? You're the only girl in the world tonight who gets to touch it." And I bat my eyes all innocent and say, "Touch what?" And he looks down at himself while he says, "The envy of all mankind." And right now I am very scared. Because when a guy has a name for his cock, you know he's not playing with a full deck. You don't want to hear anymore.
I didn't want to hear this much.
I want to sue his ass, Mix.
Then hire a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer.
I don't know his name or what room he was in or any goddamn thing about him. How can you not help me?
Because I have a very strong feeling that those three fellas that you're talking about were not elders from the Mormon church. What hotel were you in?
Dante's.
Oh, great.
A lot of people like it.
The showgirls have mustaches and the waitresses can rip the phone book in half.
Karen Young is tremendously good in it. I love how she has a terrible busted lip and a bruised face throughout her performance. You don't usually see the woman in a movie looking beaten up for her entire performance the way that Nicholson spent most of Chinatown with a big bandage on his face. Mm-hmm, like, it's mm-hmm. There's no vanity to this performance. Mm-hmm. It's a very satisfying performance. And sadly, she leaves the movie, although she doesn't die. She just drives off into the night at about the 45-minute mark, and the movie never really fully recovers from her departure, but she makes the movie even better for me. I also want to talk about the incredible climax where Pierre McNichol's character seems to have been killed, and then Nick leads the bad guys to this industrial site where he does some more moves, like he throws a rebar, like a javelin, at one person. And then there's this ridiculous death where he pours gasoline over somebody and then jumps 10 feet in the air to kick a light bulb out and the sparks set this gigantic fire. He freaks out the bad guys so much that the bad guy commits suicide to avoid getting killed by Nick. And then the movie ends with Nick on a boat in Venice. And I want to talk about this final scene with you, because it looks like they whipped it off and it's so unprofessional.
Yeah. I think it's nice that Bert got a trip to Venice.
And he looks like Grumpy Cat. Like, that's the other thing, is like, he's not happy, even though he's in his dream.
He's been dreaming about it for years, and now here he is in a gondola. You know,
and it's like,
well, I guess this is Venice.
It's not happy. It is not a happy ending, and it's ridiculous that they went to Venice to film this one shot. It's not even a sequence. It's a shot of him on a boat. Mm-hmm. So good. This movie was remade 10 years ago called Wild Card with Jason Statham. I don't know
nice.
If you bothered.
No, I haven't seen it. I did not know that was a remake.
Goldman is the credited screenwriter. All the characters' names are the same, except sadly, Statham's character is named Nick Wilde. Mm-hmm. but it's the exact same plot. And the reason why I never saw it is because it was supposed to be directed by Brian De Palma, but it, mm-hmm. it wound up being Simon West, the great Simon West.
Yeah.
What are you going to tell the company?
Goodbye.
Nobody just walks away.
Watch me.
He's looking for a second chance.
Thomas Jefferson said, the tree of freedom must be nourished from time to time. With blood.
We should be on the same side. We're so much alike.
I'm afraid you're right.
Burt Reynolds, Lauren Hutton, and Cliff Robertson. Malone.
So you watched Malone, which I haven't seen. Please tell me, what did you see Malone when it came out?
Malone had an incredible poster in video stores. Burt Reynolds firing off a shotgun with a gigantic explosion behind him and the word Malone. That's generally enough to get you to rent the movie. But Canada on Screen, this movie was filmed in BC, and it starts with Burt Reynolds as an assassin on a roof in Vancouver. He's apparently, this was a potential project for Gerard Depardieu,
but
it went to Burt Reynolds. It has an overqualified cast. Cliff Robertson is the bad guy, and he's sort of General Michael Flynn in this film. He's a Lyndon LaRouche type, and he's a land baron who's trying to buy up land to build a white ethno state. Reynolds is a CIA killer who decides that he's had enough and he quits the company. But of course, he's told that you can't just walk away from the company. Reynolds goes driving around in Oregon and makes friends with a local gas station attendant played by Scott Wilson and his daughter played by Cynthia Gibb. But then he runs afoul of these white supremacists. It's basically Shane on a low budget, but the action is incredible. The filmmaking is pedestrian, but still watchable. Like, it's, and Reynolds is really checked out in it, and he's got a really bad wig. At least in Sharky's Machine, he's displaying his real hairline. But by the time of Heat and Malone, it's the toupee from now on. I was quite surprised by how watchable and enjoyable it was. It's like a TV movie with ownage. It's actually like super violent, except the aesthetic of the movie feels like you're watching a TV movie. It's also another example of Burt Reynolds making movies that could be Steven Seagal movies, but they wind up, it's like things that Reynolds can do that Steven Seagal can't do.
Burt Reynolds.
Can't you just once do what I say without arguing?
No.
Liza Minnelli.
What are you looking at?
Nothing.
James Remar. Richard Masser.
No!
Bernie Casey. Dionne Warwick. And Robbie Benson. Rent a cop.
Sometimes you have to go through a hell of a lot to find out what you're really good at.
Let's talk about the most masochistic movie that I wanted you to watch for this podcast.
Yeah, well, this was actually what really lured me into it, because I've kind of low key wanted to watch Rent a Cop for a really long time and have never got around to it because, like, why would you? But I've always, just seeing that poster that says Burt and Liza, and it's the picture of them with the cityscape behind them. I don't know. It's always kind of like sung to me as this could potentially be trashy fun. And it's not really, unfortunately. I mean, maybe you liked it more than me. I found this movie, there were things I liked about it, but overall I found it a pretty tough sit. It's pretty bad.
The reason that I really wanted you to watch it is because it's the apex of Reynolds' checked out screen persona.
Oh, God,
he could not be more checked out in a movie than he is in this movie.
He's anti.
And that's what I find so fascinating about.
He's anti-charismatic, don't you think? Like, and actually, I was reminded of when James Franco and Anne Hathaway hosted the Oscars, because Franco, you remember, made a very conscious attempt to be completely low key. And then Anne Hathaway then responded by, overcompensating, being incredibly energetic. And I think you see something in the chemistry between the two leads of this film. I enjoyed watching Burt in this movie just because I like Burt, and I like minimalist Bressonian Burt just doing nothing. I like him as a physical presence. I like the sound of his voice. And that's all he gives you in this movie. And Liza, you know, out of control, you know? And respect to her, by the way. I mean, she's working really hard to keep this movie alive. I think it's unfair that she won a Razzie. Any movie, anyone doing a fair evaluation of this movie would have to give her props. Not because, you know, she's annoying in the movie, but God, she's waging an unwinnable battle.
Well, you know, speaking of people and their decline, their on-screen declines, like, you know, Liza Minnelli was in Cabaret, and she's very funny in Arthur, which was only a few years
earlier. And this was her first movie in 4 years. She obviously had some, you know, well-publicized substance abuse issues. And, you know, for Bert, you know, it's funny, just like looking, doing the most basic Wikipedia research for this movie, you know, the kind of hype around it, or the people that or the way that, you know, Reynolds or his people were talking about it in interviews are like, okay, you know, like, we know that Bert's not been so great lately, but he's back in this one.
The other running theme in Bert's career in the 80s, and, you know, you can track the decline, he always did these sort of romantic partnership movies. So he had Stroker Ace with Lonnie Anderson, and he had The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas with Dolly Parton, and Best Friends with Goldie Hawn, directed by Norman Jewison, RIP. But by the end of the 80s, he's in a movie with Liza Minnelli. I don't think anybody was sort of waiting for this on-screen pairing to finally happen.
Yeah, and just a little bit more background on the movie. It was released in January on a little over 100 screens, and it grossed $295,000. And I think this movie, like, really is the death knell of Burt. Like, this is kind of the end of classic Burt, where he's, you know, an action star in, you know, expensive movies that get released to theaters.
But it was made on a ridiculous scale. Like, it's set in Chicago, but in fact, the interiors were all shot in Rome at Cinecittà.
I mean, and do you know who shot the movie?
Yes. Tell us.
Giuseppe Rotondo, you know, Fellini's cinematographer, the cameraman of Carnal Knowledge, all that jazz, Popeye, in addition to, you know, the Fellini films, Love and Anarchy, The Beast. And here he is making like a bottom rung Burt Reynolds movie. It's incredible.
Yeah, it looks like a TV movie. I was stunned to see who was the cinematographer. Jerry Goldsmith does the score, and it's this lush, you know, 60-piece orchestra.
Yeah, and you see these names in the opening credits. And the opening credits, like, the movie peaked with them for me, because, again, it's the camera, like, flying over the Chicago skyline while the heavy drumbeat 80s music is playing. And, you know, you got Bert, you got Liza, you got Giuseppe, you got Jerry. And it all just screams like movie. And I'm thinking, oh man, you know, buckle up. We're going to have some fun here. This is going to be a really competent hack movie. And it just wasn't. I mean, the problem with this movie is, like, it's so kind of, it's so formulaic. It's so paint by numbers that it really lives or dies on the charm and chemistry of whoever is enacting it. And these two, oh boy.
Well, I want to read you two telling quotes from the production. Reynolds was talking about the idea behind Rent-A-Cop, and this is a direct quote from Burt Reynolds. "The cop and the hooker story has been done a million times. The secret to doing the story is always the cop that hates the girl and the girl that hates the cop, but they need each other for whatever reason."
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You got it.
Wow, I can tell how engaged you are in this project. And the director, Jerry London, who was mostly a TV movie director, said this about Burt Reynolds. "He is an intelligent, sharp, and hardworking professional. And the chemistry between him and Minnelli is wonderful. I think Rent-A-Cop is an audience picture, the kind of film where you have a good time for an hour and 40 minutes. It is just what Bert and his audience need."
Yeah, very, very diplomatic, isn't it? It's framing it almost as like a transaction.
Well, he doesn't want to get punched out by Burt Reynolds, probably.
Yeah.
But it really does sound like he's the warmest, most wonderful man I've ever.
Yeah.
He's the kindest, the bravest actor I've ever known in my whole
life. I'm actually getting flashbacks to when I went to, when I was a student journalist and I went to a round table of Kevin Smith for the movie Cop Out. And I'm just remembering the ways that he spoke about that movie and about Bruce Willis specifically. And it's almost word for word, like what he said.
Yeah. It's like, I will use as few words as possible. Like he's talking about how it's an audience picture. It's like it made $300,000, so it wasn't really an audience picture. The other strange thing about this movie is Dionne Warwick is in it as a madam. I think it might be like she might have two acting credits in her whole life. But why is she in this movie? Why is James Remar, the bad guy, in this movie? Mm-hmm. He's wearing this Daft Punk sort of motorcycle helmet. And I have to say his death is a pretty good death.
Oh, yeah.
Bert
oh,
throws yeah. a grenade inside his helmet and then slams it shut. And then Liza shoots him and then the grenade goes off. Mm-hmm. But did you get any giallo vibes from this movie at all? Did you feel, because of the Italianness of it and the violence of it, that it was a little giallo? Not good giallo.
No, that's interesting. Well, it doesn't make me want to watch it again, but it makes me wish that I'd watched it the first time with that in mind, because I feel like through that lens, I could have found a way to enjoy it possibly. It's like a giallo in the sense that, you know, you watch a movie like Deep Red and 80% of it is awful and just has leads who have no chemistry and they're just like having incredibly boring conversations, like pedestrianly shot. But Deep Red also has like 20% of it that's really good. And this movie doesn't have that.
No.
Except for that death scene that you mentioned and maybe one or two other stray moments.
Well, there's also a scene where Liza gets randomly stabbed on her way into a car. There's like an attempt on her life. And that sort of felt like a giallo sort of out of nowhere shock.
But
trying. I was wondering if it was because of the Italianness of this movie that these things were coming
out. Well, I was actually, you know, you bring up the giallo thing and it makes me think about how I kind of wish that this movie actually like was an Italian production that, you know, got Bert, got Liza, but was, you know, entirely filmed in Italy by an Italian crew with an entirely supporting Italian cast. Like the sort of movie that, you know, would have had like an 80s Italian movie that would have had John Saxon and, I don't know, Howard Vernon and a bunch of random Italians in it. Like I would have liked that sort of Lost in Translation vibe. I think that could have given this movie just the right act. Cause as it is, it just feels too much like a normal movie. It doesn't have that dreamlike quality that I think could have redeemed it. And who knows, we could, had it been a proper Italian movie, we could all be paying $60 for the Vinegar Syndrome collection, you know, yeah. slipcase, hard box, deluxe version with a fold out poster.
The international posters for this movie make it look like a giallo too.
Yeah.
This is like the ultimate example of Bert's decline, is that this is one of those American movies that comes out around the world before it opens in the US.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When it finally opens on January 15th, that release date that everyone wants.
As we wrap up our discussion about Bert though, I think it's pretty significant that one of the hugest disagreements between Siskel and Ebert in their on-air history was over Cop and a Half, which I just love.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Cop and a Half. I assume that you...
I've seen the Siskel and Ebert clip like 20 times.
Yeah, I mean, one of Siskel's finest moments when he says, boy, where's your big red suit and beard, Santa? You just gave them a gift. did you know the story that the kid in that movie was Norman J. Golden, which the only reason I know that is because
Ebert kept praising his work.
And then the following year, like Ebert got in the mail, like a signed headshot from Norman J. Golden with a letter that was like, thank you so much for praising my movie. Your praise meant so much for me. And Ebert was like, oh, isn't that sweet? But then he noticed that the handwriting seemed a little familiar and it was from Siskel. Have you seen the Siskel and Ebert review of Broken Arrow?
Tell me.
Oh, it's so good because like Siskel's giving it a marginal thumbs up and then Ebert gives it thumbs down, and you know, Siskel starts to defend it, and then he says, "You know what? You're right. It's thumbs down. So you've convinced me, but but as payback, can you please say you were wrong about Cop and a Half?"
Yeah. There was also that sort of On Cinema episode where they each chose as the worst movie of the year the one a movie the other critic liked.
Well, and that's another one. That's another one that I think Siskel won because, you know, Ebert chose Carnosaur, and Siskel had a line that was like, yeah, okay, which one would you rather watch? Just sort of like weird, like funky, like low budget monster movie, or Cop and a Half, a movie that nobody liked.
It was just so funny that they chose that movie to have this protracted year and a half long argument over.
Yeah. So to wrap up, just I want to quiz you on a couple of movies from the Burt 90s period that I'm just curious if you've seen. Have you seen Meet Wally Sparks with
no.
Rodney Dangerfield?
No.
The last, I think, theatrically released Rodney movie. have you seen Bean?
Of course not. I didn't know that Burt Reynolds was.
I'm sorry. You say of course not. I mean, you're speaking to a member.
I'm not
of,
a beanhead. I know that you're
speaking
that
you're, to a member of the millennial generation here. I mean, we all saw Bean.
Bean is a yeah.
Are you gonna Mr. say? Bean ooh, I liked Blackadder. I liked, you know.
No.
You didn't. Okay, good.
I'm not one of those guys who like says I prefer the earlier, funnier Rowan Atkinson.
Right, films. Right. If you're gonna hate him, just like hate all of it. Okay.
For me, I Mr. Bean has universal appeal. I'm more of a Johnny English guy, actually.
Yeah, right. I forgot that about
he
you.
He redeemed That's... himself with the Johnny English films. Yeah.
It's time
I
someone took the spy genre down a peg, you know?
I don't know. Do you think he's too old to keep playing Johnny English? Is it time to move on?
I think, and this is my idea for Austin Powers 4 as well. Like, I think it would be so cool to do another Johnny English that actually like sort of updates it for the, well, I guess the Bourne era is over, but like, let's say the John Wick era, like just forget all the Connery shit, have the joke be that it's like Rowan Atkinson as John Wick or like a Paul Greengrass star or like the more recent Bond movies, have it be like more a joke about like, yeah, Johnny English or Austin Powers, you know, wrestling with trauma or, you know, saying, you know, is there a place for Johnny English in today's world? You know, shoot it in the, like the Sam Mendes style. I think that would be like really funny and really cool. And again, if Mike Myers or Rowan Atkinson are listening, I'm here to workshop ideas.
Rowan Atkinson is also one of these, you can't say this anymore in comedy kind of guys.
Oh,
too,
well,
right?
every speech. British guy from that era is like, honestly, the whole island, we just got to get rid of it. I mean, there's something in the water over there.
Well, before we go, I want to talk to you a little bit about your latest publication, your Three Stooges publication. I know that you're a Stoogeologist in longstanding, and this is a very impressive work that you've produced, and please tell my listeners about it.
Thank you very much. The Journal of Stoogeological Studies was a spur-of-the-moment decision that I made last summer. I was just sitting around, and I thought, I just had the idea. It occurred to me as fully formed, where I thought, you know, I have a certain number of Twitter followers now. Wouldn't it be funny if I just put out a call for submissions for a Three Stooges zine of some kind? You know, could be 10 pages, could be 100 pages, could be, you know, who knows what happens. And like, out of a certain number of thousands of people following, like, what sort of response would I get to that? So I put out a call for submissions of like anything you have on the Stooges, you know, essays, analyses, poetry, art, interviews, anything you got, any facet of Stoogedom. And I got a lovely response from quite a few people, actually. And I, you know, these articles came in, and then some of them are, you know, some of them were like scholarly analyses of the Stooges. Others were, you know, personal reminiscences of what the Stooges meant to people growing up. Others were, you know, little explorations of lesser known facets of the Stooges' career. Like, I don't know if you know that the Stooges recorded an LP with Yogi Bear in the 60s. The Stooges did several LPs, the last of which was Yogi Bear and the Three Stooges Meet the Mad, Mad Dr. No-No. This is in the Curly Joe era. And the fact that, like, Yogi Bear got billing over the Three Stooges, that reminds me of, like, at the end of Spinal Tap, you know, oh, we said it to him a million times, it's Spinal Tap and Puppet Show, you know? And you know, I filled out the publication with some stuff of my own. I did an interview with the son of Emil Sitka, who was one of their stock company, and was actually tapped to replace Larry after Larry had a stroke in the 70s. Emil Sitka was going to be, it was going to be Mo, Emil Sitka, and Curly Joe, and they were all going to appear in the Al Adamson film Blazing Stewardesses together. But unfortunately, Mo succumbed to lung cancer before that could happen. So I spoke to the son of Emil Sitka about growing up in proximity to the Stooges. I spoke to Guy Madden, who, you know, does Stooge art and was very generous with his time, and Drew Friedman as well. So it's a whole cornucopia of Stooge content.
Friedman is a hero. Oh, I love Friedman. Yeah. I was so thrilled that he contributed to this.
He was very generous in letting me use his art as well. You know, has a lot to say. So, you know, there are some comics in it in the journal that I think are really worth the price of admission all on their own. Like, Austin Kimmel did an incredible comic. There are two Ted Healy themed comics. Austin Kimmel did one called Humbug for Healy. That's a kind of Christmas Carol type story about Ted Healy being visited by the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. And Owen Klein did a comic for me called The Violent World of Ted Healy. That's a very like depressing look at Ted's life and death. I don't know. I couldn't be more pleased with it. And the thing, it sells on Amazon for $5, which is the lowest it can be priced. Because I make no profit from it because everybody volunteered their time. So I do think it's a good deal for what's in there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, these are my favorite sort of things where somebody puts a passion project together, not for money, but for communication of their love.
Well, I just thought, I thought it would be
to find like-minded people too.
Yeah. I thought it was a funny, like, I mean, punk would not be the right word, but a funny gesture to sort of like, you know, I always like throwing a lot of, you know, periodically I like to throw a lot of time into a project, that is ridiculous and won't make any money, just for the gesture of it. I'm very proud of the fact that most of the contributors, to the Stooge Journal are millennial and younger. Although there are some, and I'm also proud of the fact that it's people like, kind of from all like, you know, there are veteran writers in there. Brian Abrams wrote a nice piece for me. Owen, who is obviously a film director of note, did that comic. And then there are people who, you know, are publishing for the first time. And I liked the sort of democratic, like, It's all in there side by side.
Will, thank you so much for coming back on the show. And where can people find you and what are you up to?
Oh, you can find me. I have a portfolio online at willsloan.ca. I'm on Twitter. And I have two podcasts, The Important Cinema Club and Michael and Us. So do tune in.
And your significant letterbox presence as well.
I guess that's true. I guess that has become a significant arm of Will Sloan Enterprises.
Will, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back anytime.
Thank you.
We'll have another episode of Junk Filter in the next few days. My next guest will be Jacob Bacharach. He's returning for a program about Dune Part 2. And also James Slaymaker will be joining us again soon for a program about The Zone of Interest. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening.